we wanted to bring together a group of experts from different disciplines within education and some practitioners who also knew the evidence to try and make some clear policy recommendations that were based on the evidence that policymakers could turn to if they were looking to try and improve education and learning in their country.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name's Tim Phillips. Improving learning is a priority for policymakers everywhere. But in a world of limited resources, which interventions offer the best value for money? A new report evaluates the evidence, gives some clear policy recommendations about what is and what is not a policy smart buy. Rachel Glenister of the University of Chicago, previously chief economist for the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, of course, was part of the advisory council that produced the report. And I'm going to find out what the report's conclusions are, but also how these recommendations should be implemented. Rachel, welcome back to Vox Dev Talks. Lovely to see you again.
Great to be here.
We've done a lot to get kids into school over the past, 20, 30 years. But the problem, I guess, is still what happens to them when they get into school.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we should stop and celebrate for a minute. That we have so many more children going to school. I mean, in most countries now, it's very high percentages, even in the poorest countries in the world, high percentages of children are going to school. And that's fantastic, but they're not learning nearly as much as we would like to see. The World Bank estimates about 70% of 10-year-olds can't read a simple sentence. And they call that learning poverty because if you can't read a simple text by the age of 10, you're very unlikely to be able to continue with your education and learn much as you go forward. Once children slip behind, it's very hard to catch up. That's a huge problem. I think it's what the education world is in development has sort of switched its mind to, and we really need better solutions.
Now, you're addressing this through, it's called the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel. Crikey. What is this panel?
GEEP, you can call it.
GEEP, thank you. So through GEEP, what is the panel? What's its purpose?
Many different sectors have expert panels. We have Lancet commissions. We have the IPCC for climate change, places where people who want to know the evidence can go and say, what is the consensus on what is effective in a sector? And education really doesn't have that. Actually, while I was at FCDO, I was talking to Jaime Saavedra, who was head of education at the World Bank. Mm-hmm. We wanted to bring together a group of experts from different disciplines within education and some practitioners who also knew the evidence to try and make some clear policy recommendations that were based on the evidence that policymakers could turn to if they were looking to try and improve education and learning in their country.
And it's important that it's lots of disciplines all working together. It's not just economists.
Yes, that's right. We have people whose background is in education, people who are economists and psychologists and early childhood experts. And it's been really interesting, actually, to work across those disciplines, also across different regions. We have people from Latin America, from Asia, from Africa. And I think that breadth of perspective leads to some really interesting conversations. And we've worked through problems, I think, in a very constructive way. Different disciplines come at an issue in a different way. But everyone really cares about evidence. And so the discussions are all based on the evidence, and people respect that. And I've learned a huge amount through that process and think about some issues quite differently as a result.
When you're talking about those discussions, does that mean you argue a lot?
People have quite strongly held views, but it's always incredibly polite and respectful.
Yes.
So people get excited, but I've never heard anyone be rude to anyone. And so it's been really good, as I say, to see that. And I think that's because everyone comes from a position of caring about the evidence. We have Kwame, it comes from more of a qualitative background. Most people are quantitative experts, but they all have this belief that it's a scientific question in a sense that we're trying to answer, and therefore, you know, debate and discussion around the evidence can help you get there.
Well, you must have had some creative discussions because you've managed to produce the report. You've produced a consensus. Now that you have this report, who do you want to read it?
So the report is aimed at people who are making decisions in education, primarily ministers of education and ministers of finance who might be thinking about how to fund ministers of education, because there's a lot about cost effectiveness in there. But other people working in the education sector who are designing programs in aid ministries, or those who are hired to design programs. But the main people that we had in our head when we were writing the report was people in ministries of education in low and middle income countries.
Well, there's a lot of research about what works well in education. You've produced quite a lot of it yourself. Do you think this report is going to be more effective than those individual studies?
I believe really passionately that you should never be making a decision on funding based on a study or even one set of methodologies. You should be looking at all the evidence. This thing might work, but something else might be more cost effective. You also want to make sure that it's both cost effective and can be done at scale. This was a big part of our decision making in the report, is that we can't recommend something that a government hasn't managed to pull off at big scale.
Mm.
It's not just a study, it's a set of studies, and it's evidence about effectiveness, it's evidence about cost effectiveness, and it's evidence that it can be done at scale. I think that is more persuasive than just here's a study.
Rachel, you evaluated the existing evidence. So how many studies is that, and where do you find them? What sources did you look at?
So this is an update to an earlier report. So there were a lot of studies in that. And then there were an additional 13,000 that we read.
Wow. Yeah.
Yes. Or that we, you know, trawled through to pull out the relevant studies.
Mm.
And these studies were that end up being referenced in the report, end up being drawn on by the panel, have to be about low and middle income countries and rigorous impact evaluations. And so there was a systematic search for studies that fit that criteria and also have outcomes that are related to education, so improving attendance at school or improving learning. Actually, one of the things that we did new in this new report is that we also included outcomes that the early childhood literature looks at, which economists don't normally look at.
No.
So that was one of the benefits. Psychologists use, and early childhood experts use, different outcomes than economists. So we kind of expanded our search to include things like school readiness and the kind of cognitive tests. So test scores, outcomes, but also these cognitive tests. You get a huge body of studies from that, drill down into the ones that have rigorous causal impacts. Then we rely also on the panel's judgment. So all the panel picked because they know the evidence in their area, and they added additional studies, and they were able to draw in experience about how these things could be implemented, whether they were hard to implement. So there's a systematic review, but also a lot of judgment. And that's the point of having a panel.
And how wide do you cast your net on this? Is it really about what happens in school buildings mostly, or is it about things like health and nutrition that also have good learning outcomes?
One of the things that we did this time is we added a review of health and nutrition and the impact that those can have on education. So we're not trying to, you know, say everything about health. We're trying to say, are there things that education systems can do that improve learning, but through the mechanism of health? Again, we didn't try and take on everything on health that could possibly influence learning.
I should hope not, or else you would never be finished. Yes.
Yeah. But we did look at things that school systems could do. You can treat common ailments through the school system. So you can have mass treatment for parasitic worms, mass treatment for malaria. You can provide micronutrients. All of these are quite efficiently done through schools, although there's much less evidence on the malaria and the micronutrient interventions than there is on some other.
Well, that gets us on to what is the difference between strong and weak evidence. How do you distinguish between the two?
We have two axes that we look at, two types of ways of categorizing the evidence. One is about cost effectiveness. So, you know, something has to have strong causal evidence, not just RCTs, or not just randomized trials, but other methods to get a proper causal impact, not just correlation, matched with cost. And that gives us cost effectiveness. And the other is just the quantity of evidence. Do you have a lot of studies that are all saying the same thing? Or do you have one study that looks pretty promising, but is the only study that?
Yeah.
So it's the strength of the evidence and how cost effective. The very top recommendations have a lot of evidence for them, and they're extremely cost effective.
I imagine you didn't read every single one of these candidate reports yourself. How do you parcel out the work?
Well, as they say, we have on the panel people who are expert in different areas. I took on the health, you know, reading all the new studies on health, for example, and we had separate sessions with experts in different areas on technology, on early childhood education, etc. But then those subgroups came to the whole panel, and every section was debated by the full panel too. People had to put their case for whether an intervention should be highly recommended, a great buy or a bad buy, and then we debated it. As they say, I mean, it's the job of these people on the panel to be up on the evidence. Like, you know, they came in already knowing the evidence very well. So they've had a lifetime of reading all of these reports.
What we're constantly discussing around these kind of interventions, and I think I've even discussed this with you in the past, is that different things work well in different contexts. However, you have to produce one ranking effectively in this report. Was this contentious? How do you do it?
This is a really challenging and important thing to think through. How do you think about recommendations when different contexts require different solutions? And so we talk about that, and in general in the report, but also each particular recommendation and intervention has a section on context.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about where it was tested. It talks about what we know from the evidence about the kinds of situations where this would be useful. Some things are good at getting more girls in school. Well, if it's boys that are out of school, that may or may not be the right thing that you want to do. Some interventions are good at helping children who've fallen behind, have been tested in areas where children in the class, there's a very heterogeneous, very wide range of learnings in a classroom. And so you should do this if that's your problem. So what we recommend is each individual context diagnoses the problem, and then you look for the recommendations that are designed to solve that problem that other countries have found effective at solving that problem. And then you have to worry about local implementation. And again, in our context section, for each intervention, we talk about context, like this is very hard to pull off, or this is quite simple to pull off. If it's very hard, you might need to do it in a place where you have a very well-oiled bureaucracy being able to implement complex interventions. That's not true everywhere.
But eventually you do fix on some of these, which you classify as great buys, real winners. What sort of interventions come into that category?
So we have three in that category. Two are newly promoted to that category. So I'll start with those. Great buys are highly cost effective, and there's lots of evidence. So one is structured pedagogy, which is a term that's used to mean all sorts of different things. So we actually define it quite carefully in the report of what we mean by this. But it's a way of teaching in the classroom that sets out a framework for how teachers should address issues, a certain order, which is based on science about what you should do first and what's the next step in teaching, provides materials. It's not scripted lesson plans. Normally, it's sort of a framework for teachers to follow. The second one that's been recently promoted is teaching at the right level, or targeted instruction to the level of the child, of which a particular pedagogy, teaching at the right level, is one of the ones in that category that has been tested many times. And the third one is providing information to students for example, about the benefits of going to school or for what are the best schools in their area. So there's lots of different forms of information, but it's so cheap to give information.
To the category that interested me are the promising interventions, but with limited evidence so far. So what sort of thing comes into that category? And why is that limited evidence?
There are quite a few things in that category. One of them is using mobile phones to improve learning.
Mm.
That's a good example of why there's limited evidence. It's relatively recently that people have been trying to teach children through mobile phones. Why? They started trying to reach children during COVID.
Yeah.
We were using Zoom and things in high-income countries, but most children didn't have access to computers, but a lot of them had access to phones. Not all, but some did. So there were attempts to try and reach children through mobile phones. The results look pretty promising, but there's still just a few studies. No government school system that I know of is doing this everywhere repeatedly on a consistent basis. So that's one of the things that we look for. Another example is some of the health examples, mass school-based treatment for specific health conditions, eyeglasses. A lot of children around the world need glasses and don't have them. It really reduces their ability to learn. But again, we don't quite have enough cost-effective evidence, enough evidence that this can be done at very big scale to be really confident before telling a government to spend a lot of money and rolling this out everywhere.
Of course, the category that everybody's interested in, the bad buys, the things that don't work. What's a bad buy?
It's interesting because it took quite a bit of guts, I think, actually,
yes,
for the panel to nail their colours to the mast and say, look, these things are bad buys.
Absolutely.
These are areas where there's a lot of evidence, but there's a lot of evidence that these things aren't very cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them can have some positive effects, but they're just really not cost effective. I think the most important one is just providing computers without anything else. It really has repeatedly been shown to not be a cost-effective thing. And mostly, that has no impact on learning.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, oh, but people have to be trained. And yes, but even then, you have very little impact. But it takes time away from other things. In school, there's an awful lot of time spent making them work. But people love it. Governments love it. It's something very tangible they can commit to do. We think it's really important to say quite clearly that this is not a good use of education resources.
As an economist, well, as a University of Chicago economist now, are you surprised that these bad buys just continue to exist at all?
No, I'm not. I'm not surprised. There's lots of reasons why people continue to turn to that. There's good reasons and bad reasons.
Yeah.
Bad reasons, people make a lot of money off these kinds of contracts. It looks, as I say, something very tangible, and it looks sexy and technological. And then there's kind of the gut reason of just, it feels terribly unfair that kids of rich families have access to this technology and poor kids don't. And so a lot of people are motivated by that, which mm-hmm. I can understand. It's just, if you really care about kids and your resources are limited, there's a lot of better things that you can do, and you owe it to them to do the thing that can help them most in their learning.
Rachel, one thing that some people might think about this report is you focus on individual interventions here. Is there a danger in doing that rather than thinking about systemic reform to learning?
I think system-wide reform, by which we mean having an education system that's focused on improving learning, is extremely important, and it's a complement to the specific things that you can do if you have everyone aligned and they really want to improve children's learning. You've then got to make some decisions about what to do.
Mm.
So I see these two things as complementary rather than distracting from systems-wide reform. We talk quite a bit about the importance of system-wide reform in the report. But I do want to also say that most of these individual interventions were tested on their own. Mm-hmm. Right? Without anything else, not least because quite a few of them are from randomized trials. So the system was the system that it was, and you just changed one thing and kids learn more, and often substantially more. So systems reform is important, but you can't always pull it off. You can't always have a political system that is really focused on improving the lives of children and particularly improving learning and is really dedicated and has lots of resources. And that's not the world we live in, that every country has that system. These are things that you can do in the meantime. And also, if you are dedicated and you do want to have an effect, these are things that you can do when you have the resources. I think it works for good systems and bad.
You say you can't always pull it off. It's also very difficult to know if you have pulled it off. You know how difficult it is to evaluate whether an intervention's working. At that policy level, is there an argument that governments need to become much better at knowing whether these policies that they put into place are working, where they're working, how well they're working, so that they can focus on the ones that really are delivering? Is that a change that has to be made as well?
I think in general, in the education system, we need to be getting more evidence about what's effective. I don't think government should evaluate everything they do. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite hard to do a good evaluation, or at least they shouldn't be doing a rigorous evaluation of everything they do. They should be checking that what they think is being implemented is happening.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there's a level of evaluation of which is just, you know, are teachers showing up to work? The main thing they should be checking is just, are children learning? You can't really fix the problem unless you know where children are. And one of the big things that we've learned through research in the last 10 or more years is a lot of the problem with children not learning is we've designed curricula and systems that assume they know more than they do.
Mm-hmm.
So we're teaching children in ninth grade level of the curriculum when most children are at the third or fourth grade level. And a child isn't going to learn if the teaching is aimed three or four or five grades above where they are. So, you know, if you did one thing, finding out where your children are, and that's particularly relevant post-COVID, how far have children fallen behind due to COVID? And the evidence where countries have done this is they're in a much worse level than they were. Not everywhere, surprisingly, but a lot of countries there are much worse. So you need to go out and diagnose. And our last GEEP report was about recovering from COVID and the importance of finding out how bad the situation was post-COVID. So that's the kind of basic evaluation that everybody should be doing. And then you should be doing some evaluation of new things, but mainly drawing on all the experience and expertise of other countries. You know, we don't want every country's just doing it on their own and not learning from others. And that's what this report is designed to help them do, is marshal all the experience of other countries in designing their own reforms.
Countries in the global south tend to be young countries. The sorts of things that are in this report affect hundreds of millions, billions of young people now. What is the risk if the policymakers in those countries do not get this right?
Huge amount of wasted potential.
Yeah.
Increasingly, we as a world are going to be relying on young people as we become older to generate the ideas, to provide the output of the world, and they will just be providing less output. They will be having less enjoyable lives if they can't read a letter from a friend, read the newspaper, be able to do simple math so they don't get conned in the market. This is really basic, important tools for the rest of your life. So it's important for the children themselves as they grow up. It's important for their economies, and it's important for the world. We know also that there's causal evidence that education leads to better health outcomes. Taking preventative measures, you're more likely to use fertilizer or improve crops. It works through every part of our life if we have a sound footing in education.
Rachel, it's great to talk to you again. Good luck with GEEP and the report.
Thanks very much.
The report is called Cost-Effective Approaches to Improve Global Learning. What does recent evidence tell us are smart buys for improving learning in low and middle-income countries?
This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Wherever you find your podcast, you will find us there and our past episodes. As always, we're at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.